Good afternoon. My name is Steve Bernard. I am the presiding judge for the oral arguments today. To my right is the Honorable Nancy Lichtenstein, and to my left is the Honorable Sean Conley. We constitute Division 7 of the Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have two cases on our 130 docket. The first of these is People v. Jefferson. Our counsel here and ready to proceed?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Thank you. The second is People v. Medina. Our counsel for that case here and ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
This question is directed at all four of you. Have you all four received copies of our one-page direction for oral argument? Do you have any questions about those? Okay. Before we get going, then, I would like to ask and make sure that everyone in the audience understands that if you have a phone or a pager or another electronic device that might go off in the course of the argument, please either turn it off or turn it to silent so we don't interrupt the counsel. And with that, if there are no further questions, we're ready to proceed on People v. Jefferson. Counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim Helfrich, and I represent the defendant appellant, Mondre Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is here today with his wife, Raquel, and we're glad to be here today. It's not a secret that Mr. Jefferson came to me while I was working at a legal aid clinic at the Denver Rescue Mission. I will just confess right up that I'm not an expert in criminal law, as I know the panel is from your bios, but I just hope you'll be forgiving if I pronounce a famous case incorrectly or stare blankly if you use a term that I'm not familiar with from criminal procedure.
Mr. Helfrich, no need.
Thank you.
And by the way, I read that opening brief. So that's one of the best pro se briefs I've read. And then I got to the last page and saw it was kind of not entirely pro se. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Jefferson's sentence is too long. The maximum sentence should be 16 years. Instead, he was sentenced to 20 years. Now, this is exactly the type of situation that is addressed by Rule 35A, of the Colorado Rules of Criminal Procedure.
About 35C, is it addressed by that as well?
It's not addressed by that, and that's because Rule 35A addresses illegal sentences. And an illegal sentence is one that is outside the structure of the statutory scheme. So, and a classic example is like this one, where the sentence, the range is 4 to 16, and the sentence is either too great, as here, or if it's too small, then you see a number of cases where the prosecutors appeal them because they're too small, because, for example, if the sentences needed to be concurrent instead of being consecutive, consecutive instead of concurrent, then the sentence is too small and it can be appealed as illegal for that ground.
Mr. Helfrich, let me ask you a question about your statement that it is too long. Now, if I understand correctly, for a Class 3 felony at the time, the presumptive range, assuming no extraordinary risk or anything like that, was 4 to 12, right?
That is correct.
And that would have meant that the aggravated range would have been up to 24, right?
No, it's my understanding that the range was up to the enhanced danger element. Took it up to 16.
I understand that. I understand that, which would make it up to 32. But even assuming that we didn't have that factor here, and the sentence range was 4 to 12, the presumptive range, it could, with a finding of aggravation, be up to 24. Would you agree with that?
And here I have to confess that we're a little beyond my expertise in criminal law. I don't know the answer to that question.
All right. Well, let's assume for the purposes of discussion here that what I've told you is so. And obviously, let's just assume.
Yes.
If that is the case, and the range for just a plain old Class 3 felony could have been up to 24, can you point me to any case that says that the difference between the top of the presumptive and the top of the aggravation constitutes illegal sentence territory as beyond, as opposed to beyond the top of the aggravated range? Can you point me to any case that says that?
Okay. I think that I can, but I'm not sure, so I'm not going to say that definitively. But I believe that several of the cases that are cited in the brief indicate situations where the judge, they looked at where the judge had actually set the sentence, and they looked at, I believe, that it was in this case, you know, 4 to 16 instead of 4 to 24. They looked at what the judge did and the rule of law that the judge applied to the sentence itself. And if it was outside the scope because the judge was applying the wrong statutory scheme, they applied the illegality rationale. And the cases that I would specifically refer you to, I read a whole bunch of them this morning. I want to make sure I get the right one. And I may not be able to do that. Let me see if I can. Okay, this is, it's a little different, but the one I'm thinking of is okay, and maybe this is more analogous, People versus Dunlap, 222 P3rd 363. In that case, the court found that the sentence was illegal. Okay, no, I'm going to correct that, sorry. Okay, here, People versus Rockwell, 125 P3rd 410. And what I'd like to get at here is, I think in People versus Rockwell, that discretionary parole instead of mandatory parole. And the court found that it needed to be discretionary parole rather than mandatory parole. So it was within the limits. It was a question of it not fitting the statutory structure, what the court was doing. So, for example, there are a lot of situations where sentences are found to be illegal that are within the presumptive range, with things like mandatory parole. Another one's whether or not the sentence should fix restitution or not. That's People versus Dunlap, the one I cited earlier. Another example would be situations where
Mr. Helfrich, I understand those examples. What I'm talking about specifically is the number of years, where here it is your position that nothing over 16 was permitted because that was beyond the presumptive range, and what kicked it into the presumptive range at the time was the express finding by the trial court that your client was on bond. However, I'm wondering about cases that talk about, is it illegal, as we view that term in 35A, for a sentence to be in the aggravated range, which is authorized by statute, where otherwise it would be in the presumptive range?
Okay. I don't know that I can cite you to a specific case on that. The cases that I looked at seem to be applying the law that if the court is applying the wrong statutory structure, which the court was doing here, because it's not just that he was on bond, it's that he was on bond for a felony.
And when that felony, which he was later convicted, and then it was,
and
that's
it was
the statute.
Reversed, right.
So at the time the sentence was imposed, it was a lawful one. At the time it was imposed, it was authorized by law.
That's correct.
And then retroactively, you're saying, once the conviction was reduced, I guess, from a felony to a misdemeanor, this sentence became unauthorized. And I guess my question to you, as a matter of policy, apart from case precedent or otherwise, this is something that could, and in the people's view, should have been challenged far, far earlier, in the interest of your client as well. It's not your fault, obviously, but it's something that should have been challenged years ago. And why, you know, doesn't the legislature in Rule 35 A and C intend finality, except for the very limited case in which it is not authorized on its face, as opposed to something that happens later on?
Right. And that's because 35C has a very specific statute of limitations, and 35A doesn't. And the law is actually very well established that a 35A challenge can be brought at any time.
It's also established under the Wenziger case and other cases that 35A should be construed narrowly for that very reason.
That's true. But Wenziger does not apply to a situation where the wrong statutory structure is being applied. Wenziger applies to, I believe it's, okay, apprehendi. I think that's the word for the challenge in that case. And that was not a situation where the sentence was, as I'm saying, too long or the wrong statutory structure is being applied. In Wenziger, in fact, they even say in the text, the court indicates that if there's basically two parts of 35A. The first part is, the second part is if it's not authorized, the court doesn't have the authority. But the first part is if it's not, if it's illegal, if it's not consistent with the statutory scheme.
Jurisdictional.
If it's beyond jurisdiction. I think it's the maybe that's
yeah,
the second
I think
part.
First part is not authorized by law. I think that's
okay.
What you're,
yes.
You're
and
going on.
That is what I'm arguing.
Mr. Helfrich, let me ask you then, if it's your argument that the sentence was not authorized by law under the statutory scheme, am I to understand then what you're saying is the court was only then bound by the presumptive ranges in which it could sentence the defendant?
Right.
All right. Because what you're saying is the aggravator that the court relied upon went away once the other case had the reversal of the conviction from a felony, and it was then an entry of conviction for a misdemeanor.
That's right.
Okay, so then your argument is that the court had no authority then to enter a sentence within the aggravated range.
Correct.
Okay, is there anything in the record that would otherwise support a sentence in the aggravated range? And if so, can that be relied upon to justify it, or is it the fact that the court relied on that one section, the bond section, and since that went away, the sentence could not be in the aggravated range?
That's right, the latter of those two. And basically, the court was very clear that it was relying on this prior felony on bond or charged with a prior felony to double the sentence after applying the extraordinary risk enhancement.
So it's your position then that the court had no statutory authority for the sentence it imposed?
That's right.
And that's why it would fall under 35A.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I don't think the government has presented any case law to the contrary to indicate that, and specifically addressing the issue raised by Judge Bernard, there's no case law maybe specifically on that, but there's certainly no case law that if the court says the sentence should be from here to here, but then we're going to extend it for beyond that point for a very specified grounds, that is a legal sentence and that can stand. So we may have a new issue of law here in this very small area, and I don't know, like I said, whether or not 24 would be the presumptive potential range that it could be in with the extraordinary risk enhancer. But I do know that the court actually said indicated it went to 4 to 16, and I would also encourage the court, if that is a material issue for you in deciding this, to look carefully back to the 1995 statute, because I found that these statutes have changed considerably since then, and it would be important to look at it at that time frame. But the court seemed to be indicating that it would be added on an additional 4 years there.
Now, first, let me ask you one very specific question. Yes. What is Mr. Jefferson's status now? Is he on parole? Is he in, he's at a halfway house of some kind?
He's in a halfway house. He's almost on parole. He's close. It's something between a halfway house and parole, and I'm not sure what it's called. There's a word for it, and it's very intensive. But he's considered
ISP,
an inmate now.
Intensive supervision.
Thank you.
Is that
yes.
What he is?
ISP.
On?
Yes, that's what he's on.
And how much longer does he have in that until he does that? Do you have
I
the?
I think that's going to be up shortly, and then he'll be on parole.
It'll be a 5-year term parole, to your understanding?
I think so. All right. And it looks like I have a yellow light, so I'm going to save the rest of my time.
Certainly may.
Thank you.
Got about a minute 35.
Thank you. May it please the court, I am Jonathan Farrow, registration number 35754, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. The factual basis in this case from Mr. Jefferson's claim arose in 1996. It was then that this court, in case number 04CR558, vacated his second degree felony assault conviction and remanded for entry of a third degree misdemeanor assault conviction. Yet the defendant did not present this claim in his direct appeal. This court resolved in 2 years later in 1998. He did not present it in his first collateral attack filed in 2003, nor did he present it in his second collateral attack filed in 2006. Indeed, he waited 12 years until 2008 when he commenced the present collateral attack to raise his claim. He provides no justifiable excuse or excusable neglect for his tardiness. And he does not explain why he could not have previously raised this claim in the preceding collateral attack. Thus, his claim is time barred, and it must be deemed to be procedurally barred as well. And the district court's order the district court's order denying post-conviction relief must be affirmed.
Well, Mr. Farrow, that is so if indeed this is not a good 35A claim.
Correct, Your Honor.
Because either under 35C, assume it is a 35C claim, there's a three-year bar, or under 35A, if this is an imposed in an illegal manner issue, it's 120 days.
Correct.
But let's go to what's the core of this, at least for my question to you, which is whether this raises an issue of an illegal sentence.
Not at all, Your Honor. The defendant concedes that at the time he was originally sentenced, that the trial court acted with jurisdiction and that the sentence of 20 years was authorized by law. I mean, he stated that. At that time, it was a legal sentence. I understand that there's some confusion about presumptive versus enhanced presumptive and then aggravated range sentencing, but all that aside, at that time, he stood convicted of a felony for that on bond case, 94CR558. So there's really no dispute at all that at that time of sentencing, the sentence itself was legal. He presents a theory that it became illegal in 1996 when this court downgraded the felony assault conviction into a misdemeanor. But CrimPro 35A does not allow such a retrospective corrective action. The rule is actually phrased in the past tense. It says the court may correct a sentence that was not authorized by law. It does not say that the court may correct a sentence that is not authorized by law.
Would you concede if the sentence had been downgraded before the sentencing that this would be a 35A claim?
Before the sentencing?
Yes. And the judge had mistakenly said you were on bond and it was for a felony. At that time, the Court of Appeals had reversed that felony, downgraded to a misdemeanor. Would you concede in that case, 12 years later, if he came and said it was never authorized by law, would be a 35A?
Under the theory that I'm now arguing, yes, I would.
So the critical fact, is it after the fact that's critical to your argument?
Exactly, on this point of the argument. Mm-hmm. Because CrimPro 35A addresses the legality of a sentence at the time it was imposed. But again, that's not the only reason that when it was imposed, the sentence here was both authorized by law and entered with jurisdiction. And the reason for that is that the 20-year term falls within the statutory range. And the statutory range has been defined by this court as not just the presumptive range, it is also the double the presumptive, which is the aggravated range. And there's no dispute here that 20 years falls within that expanded range of sentencing.
Mr. Farrow, is a court authorized to sentence within the aggravated range just based on a jury's or a trier of facts finding of the conviction itself? Whether it's trial to the court or a jury, if there is a finding of a conviction, uh-huh. Is a court authorized to sentence in the aggravated range based on that finding of conviction alone?
Statutorily, certainly, there's not a restriction that would prevent that by statute. The only such restriction that could apply would be a constitutional restriction, but the prior conviction exception would apply in that instance, so there would be no Sixth Amendment problem to imposing an aggravated range sentence upon a prior finding of criminality.
This is all pre-Apprendi anyway.
Correct. Absolutely. Briefly, I just want to distinguish the Rockwell case, because in that particular case, when we're talking about parole, and the Supreme Court framed the question that way, did the court in that case have the authority to issue the parole that it did, to order the parole that it did? And it did not. It did not have the authority to do that. Here, however, as we just discussed, not only was the sentence at that time mandated by subparagraph 9A, but it was actually within the range that was allowed, that is the aggravated range. So it's certainly a sentence that at that time the judge was required to impose, and even if you had the issue of timing that we just discussed, it was a sentence that the judge could have imposed. Even if you throw out case number 94CR558, even if you take away the fact that the defendant was on bond, he could have received the very sentence that he did receive. I'm sorry, Judge.
I was going to ask you, thank you, Mr. Farrell, I was going to ask you if you are aware of any case, like I asked Mr. Helfrich, that talks about this period of time between the top of the presumptive and the top of the aggravated range, that talks about that potential period of time being an illegal sentence. Do you know of any such case?
I believe that this court need look no further than the Wensinger case, because that's exactly the question that it considered. In that case, he had been sentenced to a range that was outside the presumptive but within the aggravated range. He was presenting an Apprendi-Blakely claim, so he was presenting a constitutional challenge to his sentence. He tried to phrase it as an illegal sentence claim because it was untimely. It was well outside the three-year time limitations. And in determining that the challenge he was making was not an illegal sentence claim, but if anything, an illegal manner claim, the court noted that as long as you're sentenced within the statutory range, which doesn't stop at the presumptive, it stops at the aggravated range, then the sentence is authorized by law. And that's really what's happening here. The defendant is really challenging, retroactively, he's challenging the manner in which the trial court reached this decision of 20 years on the first-degree burglary charge. And under Wensinger and a plain reading of 35A, that is a manner claim that is limited to 120 days after sentencing. It may not be raised indefinitely.
Under that, if that is correct, then what about the case, not this case, but what about the case in which he's sentenced in this aggravated range based on a conviction that 3 years later is overturned, mm-hmm. and his convictions become final in the first case, or the second case, I guess, would be. Is he out of luck?
You know, I don't know that if he is or not, just because we don't have any authority on that. But if I were the defense attorney, the claim I would present would be under 35C. I'd follow the language that the division used in the Backover case. And that is to say that this action, what occurred, has retroactively rendered the sentence infirm, and present that as a substantive due process of law claim, which is certainly cognizable in a 35C. And as far as is it outside, if you want to change it a little bit and say, well, what if it was raised after the three-year time period of limitations? Well, when did the factual basis for the claim arise? I mean, is that justifiable excuse or excusable neglect? Most likely it is.
You're saying the first hurdle is to make it in from a converted from a 35B to a 35C? That's the first hurdle he would face.
Well, I wouldn't say convert as much as I'm at least acknowledging that there's some potential overlap for this exact claim between those two provisions.
So to be clear, Mr. Farrell, you're not saying that Mr. Jefferson, if he'd acted promptly, wouldn't have had a potential remedy. He could have raised this issue in a timely fashion if he'd done it within 3 years of his conviction, or if the decision overturning the bond case occurred later, you'd say that he would have the argument that there was excusable neglect. And he could raise it later, right?
He certainly would have the argument. And that's why I started out at the outset to say that the factual basis for this claim arose in 1996. So at least here, he certainly had an opportunity to present it, even on the direct appeal in this case, Now, I mean, we don't know exactly when the briefs were filed, and, you know, maybe this case, it trailed longer or something like that. You know, all those things would be considered if he wanted to present it in a collateral attack. And we have to remember, too, that when he filed his first collateral in 2003, the rule against successive petitions had not been codified in the new Crim Pro 35C at that time. It was more of a, you know, the rule was still out there, but it was a little more permissive. It's absolutely absolute at this time. So I just, you know, we can talk hypotheticals for a moment, and I don't think we can imagine a situation where someone would be left without a remedy as a result of our arguments. Well, for all of those reasons, the defendant's reliance on Rule 35A is misplaced, and this the issue here is not properly before the court. I would urge it to affirm the district court's denial of post-conviction relief. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Helfrich, you got about a minute and 35.
Thank you. I just wanted to come back to this issue of if we don't have a case that specifically addresses the aggravator range, which could be larger, what do we go to? I think we got to go to what the Supreme Court has said. And the other case, just the general principles that are set, People versus Everett, Your Honor, Judge Bernard, I believe that's one that you wrote, says the defendant may challenge the legality of his sentence. A sentence is illegal if it does not fully comply with the statutory requirements. And you were relying on the Delgado case for that. A sentence doesn't comply with the statutory requirements, I would submit, if the judge is applying a multiplier that he should not be applying. And even though it wasn't his fault, it's still an illegal sentence. People Delgado has a lot of language I think is useful for addressing this issue. The court has consistently held that if a sentence imposed is not in full compliance with the statutory requirements, it is illegal. And I don't see how we can say that this is in full compliance with the statutory requirements when a multiplier is being added that shouldn't be added. Thus, it has long been clear that a sentence is illegal unless all components of the sentence fully comply with the sentencing statutes. And this sentence did not fully comply because that felony was reversed. And so I'd suggest just on the general rules that the Supreme Court has laid down about illegal sentences, this was an illegal sentence. If it is an illegal sentence that's not authorized by law, then it falls under 35A. 35C has a rule against successive petitions, but that's not what we're saying applies here. If it did, it wouldn't be timely. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you very much for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.